And so that would make my administrator very happy and my...
Madam Chair, do you need somebody to move the minutes?
Minutes, yes.
Madam Chair, I would, it's the minutes for, is it for the 21st year? Am I looking? I don't have my glasses on, Madam Chair.
Oh, the 28th.
The 28th. I'd like to move the minutes of the 28th.
Representative McNamara moves approval of the minutes for February 28th. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion failed and the minutes are approved. Okay. Let's start then with Representative Lane. Is Representative Lane here?
Yes.
Not yet. Okay. Maybe we'll start then with, do we have people who have come to this bill from out of town or from a distance? Maybe Lane, is that right? Well, maybe we should go ahead and I'll go ahead and move her, or we'll have one of our members move her bill. And, why don't we have to send somebody down? Maybe.
What would you like?
Could you go down and see if Representative Lane is there? And then
he's here.
Oh, good. I thought we had somebody from out of town. I want to make sure to get him. So, Representative Lane, you can go right ahead and sit at the table and be welcome to your own committee to present your bill. If you'd like to move it,
I would like to move House File 758.
Okay, be recommended to pass, and where does it go from here?
Is this it?
I think it probably does stay here, huh?
Stays with us?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's for possible inclusion, laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this bill appropriates money for the emergency assistance and transitional housing. I think it's an increase from what we've had in the past. And this committee has toured a lot of the shelters, so we have, I think we have a good sense of the need. I would just point out, I believe you have this in your packet on Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless that shows the little map of Minnesota there. And I was just looking at the number of children in each of the sections and noticing that in each section, children are the largest number of the homeless in an annual basis there. It's something that we have discussed before here, and as I said, I've seen some of these children in the Minneapolis Public Schools, and I think of one second grade boy who's a great kid, not the best in academics, and a little bit of a handful behaviorally, and he said that they were moving, and he said his goodbyes, and we didn't know where he was going, and then we found out that he was moving to a homeless shelter, and he was back. He didn't really go anywhere, which is rather strange for him and the kids, but homeless shelters, as we know, try to get the kids back to their home school. So we begin to see something of what was going on in his life and why academics was a bit of a problem, not his focus, and his behavior could be a little off. This is a very difficult life for children. So you multiply that out, I think it was about 2,500 children in 2003, and it may be a lot more than that by now. And I would remind you of what we called the perfect storm when we took some of those visits leading to the current needs. In the late 70s, we tore down low-income buildings for convention centers, et cetera, mm-hmm. and immediately hundreds were at the doorsteps of churches. And in the 90s and 2000s, we pushed people off at supportive services, resources, and now there's an increasing gap between incomes that aren't rising as compared to the rising cost of housing. So there is a great need, and we need to be able to face some of these things that we've created as a society and find ways to deal with emergency assistance and the transitional housing. Let's see, I have some testifiers here.
Welcome to the committee, and if you introduce yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Dahl. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. The Coalition is a statewide organization of homeless service providers, advocates, and people who have or are experiencing homelessness, all with a mission to end homelessness in our state. I'll make a quick remark about the weather outside. It sucks. And I'm worried about my drive home. I hate the fact that I'm going to have to shovel before I go to sleep tonight, and I just think I got it really rough. Luckily today I was humbled. Many of you may have gotten visits from some wonderful youth as part of the Youth Lobby Day today. I was lucky enough to run into Aaron. Aaron is someone we saw on the tour of shelters. Aaron was at YouthLink, and he told his story, And afterwards, I believe it was Representative Benson who asked, well, what are you going to do tonight? And he said, hopefully I will have a friend that will allow me to stay there, because usually it is a drop-in center. It is not a shelter. I asked Aaron, what would he do on a day like today if he couldn't find a friend and if he couldn't get into shelter? What would you do on a day like today? And he said, well, he kind of rolled his eyes and he said that, well, I've done it plenty of times, I might be doing it tonight. You ride the buses as long as you can, and then when that isn't an option, hopefully you have someone else that you know that you're with and you can trust, and you get dropped off at a bus shelter that has a heat lamp. One of the people sleeps, the other person keeps hitting the heat lamp. And then after a while, you switch places. That is what many homeless youth will be doing tonight if they don't get into shelter. It is what many homeless adults will also experience. I think about my ride home and the fact that I'm not going to like being in my car, and I know that there will be a victim of domestic violence fleeing abuse in her home, and she will sleep in this car tonight, maybe with her children. This committee has the chance to increase resources for homelessness in a lot of different ways, and you already heard proposals to increase funding for homeless youth. There is no state money specifically for homeless youth, and so I hope that you do all that you can for this program. But as Representative Lane has already pointed out, this is not a situation that is unique to unaccompanied youth. We have adults, we have families, we have children who are experiencing this problem. Tonight, 7,000 people will be lucky enough to find refuge in a shelter or a transitional housing program. 1,000 will be turned away due to lack of resources, and we estimate that an additional 2,000 are living outside. And of those turned away, 4 out of 10 will be children. House File 758 is a proposal to increase emergency services funding, which is money for street outreach and emergency shelter, from a meager $700,000 per biennium to $4 million, and an increase in transitional housing operations to $12 million from the current $6 million. This would allow us to greatly improve services at existing shelters and transitional housing programs. Better quality care will result in a better degree of success. It will also allow us to greatly reduce the number of people who we turn away. There are an array of homeless services, and I admit that it can be confusing. There's street outreach, emergency shelter, congregate and scattered site transitional housing, congregate and scattered site permanent supportive housing. We have a diversity of services because we want to meet people where they're at. A victim of domestic violence may need a night in a shelter and then get into a short-term transitional housing program before they move on to independent housing. We wouldn't want to have a victim of domestic violence staying in an emergency shelter for days on end when that is not the appropriate service. Transitional housing can help meet that need. Someone who is severely and persistently mentally ill and living on the streets may need several weeks or months of an outreach worker getting their trust, eventually coming into a shelter and then getting put into permanent supportive housing. That might be the appropriate service for them. But the diversity of services should not make us think that we are swimming in funds. We are not. Today, the state provides roughly 30 cents per household per day for emergency shelter, and HUD estimates that it costs about $11 per day to provide emergency shelter. Transitional housing costs more because the types of services are more intense, and we're trying to help people out as quickly as possible into independent housing. So we're not performing very well. We're turning 1,000 people away. We're not serving people in our current system as well as we could, and we could do a better job. I just want to give a couple of examples of what it is we can do with this money. We went to the Dorothy Day Center, where we heard that 3 people would be supervising 150 to 200 people who were staying there that night, and a security guard is going to be there from 9 to 11 o'clock. What about 11 until 7 a.m.? They've applied to the state for money to have a security guard on board all night, and we weren't able to award them emergency service funds to do that. They are just one example of over 100 others. In transitional housing, we could increase a program from having 1 case manager to 2, so we could help people out better and more quickly getting into independent housing, but we don't have the resources right now. this bill would help us make a significant stride forward in helping people get out of homelessness.
Thank you. Introduce yourself, please. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Marionette Quinnell. I'm the Center Director for Project Secure, and I'd like to thank Chairperson Clark and members of the committee. I am really, really pleased to be here today and have this opportunity to speak to each one of you. I want to talk to you today about a population that you might not be aware of. Project Secure is a day shelter program, and we serve children in Minneapolis, infants, toddlers, and preschoolers, the children that call homeless shelters their home. The children in Project Secure might be invisible to some. Over half of the 1,100 babies, toddlers and preschoolers living in shelters last year were served by Project Secure. We enhance the quality of the services that homeless shelters can provide to families with the youngest of children. A typical day for a homeless shelter parent is attending to the adult business of being homeless. That means vouchering for the next evening's shelter care, housing, employment, and medical appointments. Our buses arrive each day at People Serving People, St. Anne's, Mary's Place, and Families Moving Forward. We pick up 74 children and bring them to their age-mate classrooms. Project Secure children are brought into classrooms where they are warmly greeted by familiar faces that provide a day of nurturing and kindness. A typical day for Project Secure children is sharing meals, naps, story time, play time, snack time, and literacy activities with their classmates. That's the business of being a child. Homeless children don't have the luxury of worrying about what toy they want. They worry about, where am I going to sleep tonight, what am I going to eat, and am I going to be safe, and who's going to take care of me? While children's nutritional, mental, and physical health and developmental needs are being addressed by teachers and public health nurses and dentists and developmental specialists at our school, Project Secure parents receive assistance from family advocates to access resources for child care, housing, financial management, mental and chemical health issues. Studies indicate that a disproportionate amount of homeless children have significant health issues. Our kids come to school sick every day. Project Secure staff comfort each infant, toddler, and preschool child, wiping bottoms, noses, and tears on a daily basis. While most parents can readily address their children's concerns, homeless parents have urgent basic needs that require their immediate attention and most of their energy. Project Secure can focus on the needs of the child, providing necessary screenings, referrals, and resources for the parents, and food and clothing and attention for the child. A lot of times it's mittens, hats, jackets, shoes. Children come to school without proper diapering. A child's need for stability and predictability is never more critical than when their life is in a constant turmoil because of no fault of their own, they're homeless. Everything about homeless shelter living is public. It's all public domain. Parenting, affection, and discipline all happen in public. We all deserve the dignity of privacy. Our homeless families need a private space to grieve the intense losses that they are suffering from a life in transition, and Project Secure offers that space to families. Unfortunately, for every child that is served by Project Secure, we turn another one away. If there's one thing that I can ask of you today, is to start seeing homeless children. Homeless children are not invisible. They have beautiful faces and eyes that can penetrate your soul. When we look into the eyes of a child seeking respite, trust, and safety, we can't look away. And my plea to you today is that you don't. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do you have any other witnesses?
Madam Chair, we tried to get Renee Blanchard-Lutz, who's with the Dakota Woodlands, and she was unable to make it. She does have written testimony, and so I'd like to submit that for the committee. She talks a little bit more about the types of services offered in emergency shelter and transitional housing, but I'd be happy to answer any questions about that if there are any from the committee.
That's great if you can submit the testimony. We're not surprised that we knew that she might not be able to make it considering the weather, so it's great that she sent the testimony. Any questions from committee members? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question I have on line 114 says this appropriation is in addition to any base appropriation. So am I assuming that is the governor's budget number? And if it is or isn't, and then how does this compare with the governor's number in this category?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, currently the state provides $700,000 per biennium to emergency services, and I believe the governor has proposed per biennium $350,000 more per biennium. Emergency shelter has about $5.9 million per biennium, and there's been, I think, a $500,000 increase proposed in the governor's budget. So this would go on top of each of those appropriations. We want to bring emergency services funding up to $4 million and emergency and transitional housing operations up to $12 million. What we primarily want to do with those resources to improve...
Could you repeat the emergency services to...
To $4 million.
Okay.
And transitional housing operations up to $12
million. To 12, okay. May I follow up, please? And then on the transitional housing for part of it, would that then go through MFHA?
Sure.
Typically that money is, goes through them and...
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, these are actually funds that are available through DHS. DHS, the Office of Economic Opportunity, oversees transitional housing and emergency services funds.
Okay. It does not go into MFHA.
Correct.
Okay, that's good information.
Okay. Any further questions?
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, are there any of these services covered in any other budget? I mean, I know in mental health we talked about housing issues and other committees. Are there any other sources of funding for this type of program proposed?
Mr. Dock, or
Madam Chair, Representative McFarland. There may be specific services for instance, some people who are staying in shelters are on MPIP or they're receiving some sort of mental health services, and so individuals may have specific assistance that they receive as individuals that they are also using while they're in a shelter program. This money there's no other state money for emergency shelter or transitional housing unless we're talking about domestic violence programs, mm-hmm. which have different funding streams through public safety, I believe. And this is used to pay for the service, the case management, and at times rent for building space, operating costs for the emergency shelters, the transitional housing that you're not going to get from other state funding.
Are there vehicles for them to receive these services in the outstate?
Madam Chair, Representative Farland, yes, actually these funds are currently competitive on a statewide basis. Department of the Office for Economic Opportunity funds, I believe, under 30 shelter or outreach programs across the state and transitional housing programs. I don't have the exact numbers, but there are programs in every continuum of care. There's programs, I believe, in every district of people on this committee. And the state actually does a pretty good job of even distribution.
Okay, there's no further discussion. Representative Lane, before us.
That motion?
Okay, Representative Lane renews her motion that House File 758 be recommended to pass and laid over. I guess we actually don't need to vote on this because we'll be laying it over. So we'll take your motion into consideration and we'll be back when we put the omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Omnibus bill.
Madam Chair, I know that the last agenda was already approved, but I do have an amendment to the minutes. I know the minutes were approved, but I do. If you look on the last line of your minutes, members, as the author of 1205, I don't want my bill going to taxes. So there's, I think, a mistake in here where it's supposed to be House File 1301. On the last line, Representative Moe renewed his motion that House File 1301 be recommended to pass and refer to taxes. So I would like
to incorporate that into the changes for the minutes.
Thank you
very much.
I should have had my glasses on. I said I didn't have one.
On the minutes from last meeting.
Typo.
I called it a little.
Sometimes you can believe me. It's just a typo.
Got it.
You'll know when we get to
it. We've got another deal for you, too.
Okay. We have Representative Lesh now before us here, and we have two bills. Representative Lesh, which one do you want to take first?
Let's do 166.
Okay. And that bill was laid on the table temporarily.
I apologize. I got that.
Madam Chair.
Oh, you want to do 777 first? All right, we'll do that.
Madam Chair, I'm surprised. House File 166, if I remember right, that was a bill that this committee has already had before us. And if I'm not mistaken, it failed. And so I think it would be out of order for us to take up the bill tonight.
We'll be able to reconsider it, and there'll be a motion to do that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
The proper motion.
And, okay. And for clarification on that, it'll come time. We do have an amendment on that, too, Madam Chair, so it's different.
Okay. Looks like we're going to take the easier one first.
Maybe. Absolutely.
All right. House File 777. We'll see if it's easier. Hopefully.
And, Madam Chair, members?
I'll move the House File 777 for another question.
Okay. House File 777 has been recommended to pass and be referred to tax committee.
I believe it's going to pass. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Representative Lesh, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. It's very good to be back here. Madam Chair, I'll be blunt in terms of what House File 777 does. The situation as it is now, in my experience of working on the St. Paul City Council, I noted, and this was a bill that has come up in previous years in this body as well. What I'd like to do, if I could, I'm also going to pass out copies of a handout that I passed out in previous years, if I could ask the page to help me out with that. The first handout shows the City of St. Paul, and it shows Section 8 utilization by zip code. This was done 3 years ago, almost exactly 3 years ago. And if you look at this chart as it comes around, it'll show you that the Section 8 utilization in one zip code in St. Paul is pretty much double the next highest utilization by zip code. And what that means is this, and we've got a situation on, for example, the east side of St. Paul in my district, where you've got certain housing projects that are government projects, and they're pretty well run. When you bring people from other states and you bring them by McDonough Homes, you bring them by Roosevelt Homes, you say, what's this apartment complex? I said, well, this is a government housing project. And they say, are you kidding me? This is a government housing project? It looks really nice. It's well maintained. It's kept up. The lawn is fine. It's painted, and they're very much surprised. Now we have some other situations where, when you have an area that begins to get depressed, you have landlords who come in and purchase the properties and try to rent these things out. And there was testimony in previous years that showed that when some of these landlords come in, they jack up the rent and they work out deals with the tenants whereby they get additional funds from Section 8 and they charge over market rent because the tenants are paying Section 8 prices. They allow the properties to deteriorate and run down, and what happens is you get entire blocks of areas in certain parts of certain urban areas that become de facto housing projects, yet without the same kind of regulation and maintenance as is afforded a government housing project that actually looks pretty decent. So what happens is you get these areas, people who come in, and oftentimes it's absentee landlords who purchase these homes, allow them to be run down, fill them up with Section 8 vouchers, and you end up with an entire area of a city that gets run down. We have a lot of code complaints, and you end up with the broken theory, the broken window theory of how things work in city areas, where it continues a cycle of deterioration. So the effort is that if we're able to not concentrate these Section 8 situations, we won't end up with de facto housing projects that do not receive the same kind of strict type of scrutiny in terms of regulations as we get with respect to a housing project that looks pretty good. If you look at the run that was passed out, you'll see what this bill does is it says if you have a city where there are very few Section 8 vouchers or very low concentration of poverty, and a person wants to build a project that would qualify for Section 8, you can get an abatement from that city in order to do it. That way, we will alleviate some of the concentration that we have had in past years. So that's the bill, Madam Chair, and I'm certain that some people may have some questions on it.
Madam Chair. Senator Farland.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, could you explain this handout to us then? The cities, especially the last column, does that mean the ones? You just explain this, I guess.
This, you know, it may be better for research to do this because I was just actually given this run today by research as well, so perhaps. As my understanding is qualified, is that if it says yes, that means that the city would qualify for it, which it means it has less than 10%. Of the area under the federal poverty guidelines. So that's maybe research can elucidate that.
Madam Chair? That's correct. Okay. If it says yes, it means that the city would qualify for these abatements for Section 8 housing within the city. It means that the city has a higher average net tax capacity than the average in the county. And it's one of the five counties with over 200,000 population in the state.
Madam Chair?
Representative
Lesh, has there been any discussion with the cities and municipalities?
There was in previous years, I did speak with the League of Cities today, the one person who I spoke with has said, well, you know, I mean, I'm sure there are some cities that would prefer not to have to do this, but you know, they said, well, we're not going to be heard on, we're not going to be testifying on. So I'd be willing to bet that there would probably be some general opposition from some cities, but it hasn't been really vehement that I've heard so far.
Representative Lesh, did you talk about anything about how this, the costs of this thing, of how this abatement would work, and who is going to end up footing the bill for that abatement, or realizing the loss of revenue? Or
well, remember that it is abatement, so there is technically no loss of revenue, unless you did in a theoretical but-for test with, like, similar to TIF. You know, I mean, they're not getting the revenue now. And normally, if you built the project, it would have higher taxes, but we abate those taxes. And it doesn't need to be all of it. It's an incentive abatement. So under the structure in past years that we've used, the city would be getting additional taxes, just not as much as they otherwise would if we didn't have the abatement in place.
Madam Chair, President West, how long would the abatement go on forever? When would the abatement, when would that cease?
As I understand it, and thank you, I should go through the chair. Madam Chair of San Jose, it's a small room, so I forget where.
Okay.
It would be set up with a district, and in fact, I need to look at this again, Representative Eastland, but it would be set up similar to the way that a TIF district is set up. For the duration of that district, they would receive the abatement. It wouldn't be ongoing and permanent. The idea is to give them the incentive to build the project.
Representative
Madam Chair, thank you. A couple of mechanical questions. But the abatement would go with the unit or the property address specific?
It would go through to the specifically the address, the property itself.
And if it was a 10-unit building, it would go to unit 10? If that was the unit that had the certificate?
No, it would go towards the building as a whole, and the percentage, the requirement is that 20% of the total may be considered okay. qualified units.
Okay.
So it just means that you got to have affordable in right. the project, and then the entire project would qualify.
And then, Madam Chair? Okay. So, you know, I think I like the mechanics of where it's going, and I'm just trying to figure out, so in my particular case, the Housing Authority of Bloomington acts as the supervisor of the project. They also, in order for those two units in the 10-unit building to become qualified, they could, in fact, make sure that those units met code, because it says in here code compliant. And if there were some deficiencies, they could encourage the owner to get it up to speed.
Madam Chair, supervisor to the extent that the project would qualify for the abatement.
Because they approved the certificate.
Correct. Yes.
For those two units.
Yes.
Okay. If it's an existing single family property, that gets a little simpler. So then it takes the question, who gets the advantage of the abatement? So the taxes are abated $200 because of this. You want it to go, I suppose, to the tenant. How do we enforce that the advantage is to the tenant and just doesn't get lost in the deep hole?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The idea is not that it goes to the tenant, it goes to the developer. Because a developer is going to say, when a developer looks at a project and they say, okay, I can do a 30-unit building or a 20-unit building or even a 10-unit building here, they look at the numbers. And one of the numbers they look at is the taxes. Mm. And they say, well, I can't build
mm-hmm.
a project
okay.
because, you want 20% of this to be affordable. No, I'm not going to get my money back on it, so forget about it. But if we abate the taxes, like, well, okay, yeah, mm-hmm. I can make an affordable amount. That's the idea behind it.
Okay. Madam Chair, can I? Thank you. I'm trying to get to, in our situation, where we would like to do some existing properties, because it's very difficult to find any land to build on. So I'm trying to work through my head, how can we encourage an owner who has an existing 20-unit building, which we have a lot of, that's 30 years old, needs some update, would probably qualify here, and somehow, how do we encourage him to apply to take 3, 4, 5, 6 units, get it in the program, get it up to code? Housing Authority now has the ability to help arrange housing. I mean, if it's just new construction, I don't think we're going to be able to use it. We don't have a place to put bricks and mortar. And I'm just thinking, is there a way to take this same incentive that the Housing Authority could talk to an owner and say, I don't have a Section 8 certificate for you in your building, but I can help you take 3 of these units and get them into a similar program. We can abate your taxes. You can pass that rental advantage on to these two new people that we're going to help coordinate housing.
Is
that a different program?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, I really like the idea. The thought is that this is for new construction. But one of the things that when you got no developable property, everything's built up already. In St. Paul, for example, our problem isn't, many cities with older infrastructure, all you can do as a developer is infill housing. And infill housing, I mean, it's like, where's the profit in that? It's really difficult to do. So I'm kind of in the same
mm-hmm.
situation, but providing the abatement will allow for, you know, give you a better price point on infill as well, since it's technically more expensive to do. The thought was that, to answer your question, the thought was this was for new construction. I'd be open to exploring that other possibility as well. I just hadn't considered it for the purpose of this bill.
I think it would be kind of slick if we could do something like that. I mean, because again, once the tenant has the Section 8 certificate, they're marketable and there's opportunities for them. And I see this as a supplement to that. And if we can encourage owners to add that other 20, 30, 40 units, because there's an incentive for them, and our housing authority now can come in and help that transition, at the same time can get into that building and make sure that we get the plumbing up to speed and the smoke detectors and all those other kinds of things that 30-year-old buildings need to deal with.
Just to kind of not to waste the committee's time with thinking about this on the fly, but I imagine that it would make a building very marketable as well for an individual owner who chooses to take advantage of a program like this, and all of a sudden they put it on the market. I mean, it's worth a lot more. There would be substantial incentives, I think, for individual private owners to take advantage of something like that. I'd be interested in exploring that more with you.
I just say that I can support the bill. I just don't know how I'm going to use it. And the problem, we might be able to do it in Lakeville or, you know, Jordan or Young America or something where they've got dirt. Mm-hmm. That's the dilemma.
Representative Mark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, and this is probably, maybe it was what Representative Peterson was talking about. I apologize, I came in late. I was downstairs for another hearing. Subdivision alone here. It's on the second page, under G. Qualified city or town means a home rule charter statutory city or town that is located within a county of 200,000 more inhabitants and whose net tax capacity per capita exceeds the average net tax capacity per capita of all cities or towns in the county which is located. Could you just explain to us why that second part is necessary?
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Matt. And were you going to ask other questions?
No, that's it. Okay. When looking at house research for the other towns that aren't the towns within the seven county metro area, which this doesn't qualify for, perhaps not having that portion in there.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, I'll answer that in terms of how I think I understand it. The intent of G is so that we don't end up, foisting this upon low tax base localities who are going to, complain, there you go, taking up more of our real estate with abated taxes, that they won't be in a position where they have to deal with that. The answer to the with a county with 200,000 or more inhabitants, I got to be honest, I can't recall why we put that in there. This bill I started, I think, 3 years ago, and I can't remember why we have it at over 200,000 or more. I can find the answer for you on that, though.
Madam Chair, I guess my question was more specific to, I understand looking at a county more 200,000 or more inhabitants, that's the seven county metro area, and that seems to be the target of this. But number two, whose net tax capacity per capita exceeds the average net tax capacity per capita of all cities and towns in the county which is located. So you're pulling out a lot of the towns and saying, this is, you qualify because you're more wealthy. But Representative Peterson knows it better than I do. I mean, isn't how the county property taxes are fairly uniform throughout the county. It doesn't vary so much town to town within the county, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Peterson,
yeah. In existing communities, typically those county tax values are quite low, and they might have difficulty getting to that threshold. Again, you go to Lakeville or something like that, there's no problem. And I think that's what you're reacting to. You want to use your community. And some of those towns, the counties already have a low enough base, they may not be able to meet that threshold, and yet they want to do it.
Yeah, I guess my point is that in section from number two within this section, and I think you were writing your bill, Representative Rush, I just thought if removing that last section, two, would increase the usefulness of this legislation. It might make Representative Peterson's point where he would have greater, it would have greater usage perhaps within Hennepin County or whatever county it would be applied.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Moe. What I'd like to do is, I believe this is addressed in the run, is that correct? The average, those whose average net tax capacity increases. And it would expand the number of localities that it would use. I guess what I would say, Madam Chair, Representative Moe, is this is going to the tax committee. I'd like to look at that a little bit more and maybe talk with Representative Peterson and yourself as well to see if this is going to meet usefulness of areas that are going to want it. We want it to be used by communities that want it. That's the primary thrust.
Representative Lane.
Support your bill on that.
Oh. I would, from my understanding of it, and I must say that you may be a lawyer but not a teacher.
Sorry.
It was very hard to catch up to what you were talking about here. But from my understanding, and I may be wrong, that Part 2 under G is a key part of the bill because it says the areas that have enough tax base that they can afford to not take the tax base from this development can bring in affordable housing and hence spread out the concentration so that it's not all concentrated in the areas that are low income to begin with. And as you look down the cities that come out with the yes, you can see, yeah, it would spread it out a little to places that maybe don't have very much now. And it would give an incentive, and it wouldn't necessarily hurt the city because they have a better tax base than the rest of the county in that area anyway. My only question is, how long does this tax property tax abatement last?
We're going to structure. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Lane. We structure it the same way a TIF taxing.
25 years.
Well, you don't have to run a TIF district for 25 years. You can limit it. The council can limit it to however it would be. But that would be as well up to the housing authority.
So this is, Madam Chair, this then is worked out between the city and the developer.
Correct.
They decide whether they're going to do it, how they can come to an agreement, and how long they might do it.
Madam Chair, Representative Lane, yes.
Representative Lane, you are a very good teacher, however. A lot of us, I think.
Yeah, I understand
that
too.
Madam Chair, Mr. Representative Lesh, what about areas like Rochester or Duluth or St. Cloud that have quite a big population? Is there a need in those areas too for this kind of?
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, I think there probably is. I sought to address this in an area, the Twin Cities, because I didn't know a lot about kind of the housing situation in those areas and chose not to attempt to seem like an expert, which I'm not an expert on Twin Cities either. But if it works in other areas, I would see this as probably an expandable program.
Thank you.
Any questions? If not, let's see who moved this bill. Representative Kranz moves that House File 777 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the committee on taxes. And for the discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevailed, and House File 777 is on its way to taxes. Now, we have before us, unless you wish to take up. House File 166, you need to move to reconsider that bill. Is that what you...
Yes, I would like that, Madam Chair.
The motion is to move to reconsider the action by which House File 166 was recommended to be referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice, so it will be going to that committee. Motion.
Safety.
Representative Morgan moves that it be that we reconsider the action. and it would go to public safety and civil justice.
Madam Chair.
Discussion. Representative McNamara.
We're kind of hidden here today, Madam Chair. We've got to dodge through the chairs. Madam Chair, I really would ask that we do a reconsideration at a regular scheduled committee time. Two of our committee members are down chief authoring the smoking ban bill on commerce, and I really don't know if we should go down and ask to pull them away. They're on the testifying right now. I would imagine it's their bill. They're the number one and number two author. I think we deserve to have everyone here. The other thing going on is this is a snowstorm. This committee has dealt with this issue already. I don't think it's fair to both sides of the issue that we're here and testified for us to spring this on them now with in the middle of a blizzard, Madam Chair.
Well, Representative Mayor, this isn't springing it on anybody. Both this meeting was scheduled and this bill was posted on it, and all the ways it's supposed to be, plenty of time. So, I mean, there's nothing unfair about it. I appreciate the fact that people are trying to be in other committees, and that is a problem for all of us, and we do have to go back and forth. If you want to send someone down to get them this time. But the proper notice was given, and unfortunately, we're going to keep running into this as we go along, where people are going to be back and forth between the various committees.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
We can obviously move ahead. I think the issue is that we are on a tight schedule. There is, but at a regular committee time, people are usually a little more able to, when there are a lot of extra things happening, there are extra committees that everybody's being called into, even to present bills. Obviously you're the chair, you can do what you want here, but it just seems like it would be more fair, since this bill has already been dealt with in committee, to do this at a time when everyone that participated and all the testifiers can actually get here. I mean, there's a lot of people that I don't know if there's testifiers that couldn't come that would have liked to have come on either side of this bill. But there's obviously a number of testifiers that I'm sure that aren't here because of the storm. So, I just think there's just a fairness issue, since we've already dealt with this, would be that we could hear this during a time when we're at a regular scheduled meeting and we don't have this conflict.
Any other comments? Representative
Lynch?
I believe that we have given proper notice, and I'm sorry if it seems unfair to others, but I think that we can't be any more fair than we are. So the motion is before us to reconsider. Representative Morgan moves that we reconsider the action by which this bill was recommended to be passed and be referred. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No?
No.
Motion prevails.
Division.
Okay, let's have a division. Motion called for. All those in favor, please raise your hand.
For the whole bill?
Should we consider it? Anybody? Okay. Those opposed, raise your hand. Motion 7-4. Nine to four. The motion does prevail, and the bill is back on the table. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have, in the committee has obviously already heard this, and I think we took over an hour last time, but maybe more than that, to talk about it, and so it's been hashed out quite a bit. So in order to save the committee's time, I would say that we have a proposed compromise amendment, which you've all received in your packet, amendment 166A1, which I would ask to be incorporated as an author's amendment.
Does anybody have 166A1?
No.
Representative Lesch, why don't you explain the amendment, and then Representative Mark, would you like to move that amendment?
Yes.
I think we need to move it.
Madam Chair, I'll move the A1 amendment to House File 166. Okay.
And thank you. And this, and I did work with Ripson Morgan on this, Madam Chair. It was a good idea that Ripson Morgan came up with. It said essentially this: on this fee, which we have uniform fees, so landowners can rely on a consistent uniform fee now. But if you come and you bring one of these uniform applications that has all the information that you need as a landlord in order to make a qualified decision about a tenant, but you think there's something fishy about it, or it's all been explained to you, you know, just like how we always explain the campaign contribution refund program to people, but no one really believes us, and so they got to call in the Department of Revenue and confirm it. I'm like, are you serious? Yeah, sure enough. So say you're a landlord and you don't really buy that this is an accurate transferable type of screening report. You can say, okay, you can charge a fee up to $30 to cover the actual cost of obtaining an update. But if this update, if you're wrong, if this update does not provide any additional negative information, you got to refund them the $30. So we think that's a fair way to go about it, that you're covered as a landlord, you can know what's factual, what's not. Remember that this bill only applies if you charge a fee in the first place at all. If you don't charge a fee, it doesn't apply to you. So I think I talked with folks, members of the committee. It struck me as an acceptable compromise, and so I think it makes sense. I would ask it to be incorporated. I guess we already did that.
Any discussion? Okay. Representative Peterson.
And I'm sorry, I don't have the recall of all the discussion, but weren't there several people that testified? And does this address that testimony? And if not, the issue that Mr. McNamara, Representative McNamara, was talking about, are there some people out there that are going to be stern that testified pro or con?
Obviously, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Peterson. Obviously, multi-housing can answer what their problems will be additional. To the bill despite the amendment, but I think from my recollection of the testimony, the primary thrust of the testimony is that how can you really rely on this? How can you really rely that you're going to get your $50 back if I give it to you for your campaign? Same principle. But you ought to be able to, under this amendment, address that, and you can charge the fee if you really have a problem with it. And there are some other problems too, but most of the other problems that I recall were speculative problems based on what may actually be in that uniform report. So the bill calls for the Attorney General to work with landlords and screening companies and tenants to come up with the uniform application, which hasn't been done yet. The bill just calls for that. But a lot of the testimony said, hang on a second, what if this isn't in there? Or what if this isn't in there? What if I want to screen for this and it's not included? What if I don't want to screen for that and you're charging me for it? A lot of the testimony revolved around that, but that hasn't even been done yet. And the Attorney General is going to work with members of the industry to do it. Insofar as the bill itself, I think this amendment addresses 90% of the objections to the bill itself, other than the speculative nature of what could be in the actual application. But obviously, multi-housing probably a good answer.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and to the author. I had a constituent that got a hold of me and said, you know, I don't know if this necessarily, you know, how this impacts, because they said, you know, when we have prospective tenants that come to want to rent our facility, we say, you know, if you have this on your list, and they listed a couple of things, and I don't remember the email in particular, but. And then they said, you know, if you have any of these things, you really don't bother, in a sense. Would this bill impact it in any way? I mean, I'm assuming that a landlord could still have this kind of prerequisites that they would say, you know, if your background check has these things on it, it's pretty unlikely that you're going to rent from here. I mean, a tenant could still do that, couldn't they?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Kranz, yeah. But I would caution you to ask, for example, that may be one of these landlords that's how they always operate, and they always have operated. From my experience, landlords make different decisions based on what kind of market cycle we're in. Because as I testified last time, I do that now too. I mean, if you have a forged check on your criminal background, or if you have an unlawful detainer, for the most part, unless you have a really good reason or something like that, no, it's a bad risk. But there have been markets where I have considered that, and I've rented to people with unlawful detainers. in it's been suggested that this is a black and white issue. Either you qualify or you don't. But if that were true, there would be no reason to do the exhaustive types of things he has in these reports. There are a lot of different factors that screening companies consider because a person has to look at it in its totality. And so, despite what some people may come up and suggest to you, no, either you qualify or you don't, so it's a waste of time. That's not true, especially in a down market for landlords, which we had, 2 years ago, and it wasn't pretty. So, I guess what I would say is to a landlord like that, that may be how you operate, but that's not how everyone operates, because there are a boatload of people out there who are renting who have these things on their records.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, is there anybody here to testify for or against the bill?
Sure, I'm sure there are. We'll have people to testify. I presume I see people from the Multi Housing Association. I think what we need to do is just vote on this amendment to get it in the form the author wants, and then we'll have any testimony of opposing or supporting it. So I think the amendment's been explained. Is there any further discussion on the amendment itself? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now, testimony from anyone who wants to support or oppose the amendment, or the bill, excuse me, the bill is before us. And I think there's probably a couple
of people. I think, Madam Chair, Michael Dahl is here in support of it. You heard from him before. I guess I'd rather save the committee time and not rehash it. You've heard it all before. I don't think multi-housing has had a chance to be heard with respect to the amendment, but I don't want to testify in favor of the same things that we've already testified to before. So in the interest of time, I'll just save our time.
Okay. Mr. Horner, did you care to testify?
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Okay. Jack Horner, representing Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, Madam Chair, members, Representative Lesh. We appreciate the work on the amendment, but it does not address the main concerns that we have. It does not address the fundamental problems that this bill has. And I do want to refresh just briefly some of the testimony that you heard a few weeks ago. There was a huge amount of information that we tried to compress into a very short time period. And this is one of these bills that sort of on the surface looks like it might be okay, but you have to delve into it to really understand the problems that it raises. The problems essentially are threefold. First of all, it completely perverts the credit industry, the background check, the method of doing credit checks. The essence of a credit check is a third party who you trust, a reliable third party, says, this guy pays his bills. This guy's credit is okay. This guy's reference is okay. If Horner says Horner pays his bills, that's useless from a credit perspective. If anyone says, I myself am a good guy, you ought to trust me, even if I put it in writing, even if I give you a form that says, I'm a good guy, trust me, it's worthless. I mean, it is literally worthless from a credit point of view. The essence is a third party that you know, that you trust, that is reliable, tells you it's okay. You can trust Horner. We've checked him out. He pays his bills. The essence of this proposal is somebody writes out a form or gets somebody else to write out a form, hands it to a landlord and says, you have to accept it or you run the risk of having to pay. The fact of the matter is that these forms are going to be available everywhere. I mean, they have to be. There's over 100,000 landlords. There's dozens of screening companies, dozens of out-of-state screening companies. Anybody can call himself a screening company. The form will be on the web, no doubt. Anybody can download it. It'll be very nice looking. It'll say State of Minnesota Official Screening Report, something like that. The fact is, there are some people who lie. There are some people who write forged checks, who forge documents. The police who were here testified to that. It's a real problem. There are people who steal other people's identities. They do it when the opportunity arises. You heard testimonies of that. One of the screening companies reported that somewhere between a fourth to a third of all the tenant screening applications that they get in which a tenant was turned down have material falsehood in them. It's done for the purpose of defrauding the landlord and the neighborhood in which the building is located. And why wouldn't they? I mean, the person has got a bad record. He's trying to find someone that he can either get to not screen or not screen well. He may do that by changing the name, by using someone else's name, someone else's social security number, by not mentioning he lived here when in fact he lived there, not mentioning that he, the county he lived in where he was arrested a couple of times and he just claims to live in the other county. There's a lot of ways of doing it. This opens up that window of opportunity. It opens up the window of opportunity for ID theft, for forgeries, for just a lot of bad things, because all of a sudden everybody in the state who wants it has access to kind of an official looking form that they can fill out and give to a landlord. Unfortunately, some will accept it. They shouldn't. And we all wonder when we read the paper, how is it that somebody got duped by this or that scam or confidence game or something? And you wonder how that happens. Well, the fact is some people do. Some people aren't careful, at least the first time. They learn eventually, I guess. The amendment says that we can remedy the situation of a landlord not being able to screen or check it by allowing him to check or verify or confirm the screen, and there'd be a $30 fee for that. That absolutely does not, cannot, will not work, would be illegal, in fact. And you heard testimony to that. The Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act is very clear, very specific, and the contracts that these screening companies enter into with the big three credit companies, they're very explicit. Both the law, federal law, and the contracts say you must have a contract between the credit screening company and the provider, the so-called reseller of the information, the screening company in this case. You must know who your end user is. You must have a contract with the end user. You must have verified, these are all in the law, and the contracts that the screening company signed. You must have verified that the end user is a legitimate company with a legitimate need for credit. You probably hire a company called a third-party verifier for $50, $70, $80. They'll go out to the landlord's office. They'll see that he actually is a landlord. He actually is in business. He actually needs credit information. Then the tenant screening company can sign the contract with that screener. A tenant screening company will get in big trouble, lose its right to credit information, which essentially shuts them down, and violates federal law if he doesn't know each and every user, end user, of that credit information. Most tenant screening companies cannot even give the reports to the consumer, to the tenants. It costs more to get permission to do that. Some screening companies do that, they have that permission. But they pay for it, they buy it. It costs more. The net effect of that process is it increases the cost of screening for everybody. Not a desirable result. Tenant screening companies cannot give the information, so what would happen? Some guy calls on the phone and says, "Hi, I'm a landlord. I got a screening report. Give me Fred Smith's credit information. I want to check it out." Well, we wouldn't want that to occur. That's not a policy we'd want to encourage. And, again, it would be against the law. You can't do it. So the only way that a landlord could get around that would be to do the full-blown credit, the $50 credit check. Roll the dice. Maybe he'll get reimbursed. Maybe he won't. Or just simply accept what's in front of him, which literally is worthless and should not be accepted by anyone, and we should not be encouraging people to accept that kind of a statement. The next problem with it is that it's a strong disincentive to screen. So not only the fraud issue, not everyone's fraudulent, but enough are so we have to be on our guard, and we don't want to create opportunities. The next issue, strong disincentive to screen. Some landlords will be duped. Some will choose not to roll the dice, not to do the rechecking, and it's expensive after all. And then have to fight with the applicant as to whether or not the new report's a little different, a little better, a little worse, slightly different. Is it substantially different?
And this was the police objective. And they testified strongly against this bill. Now, there was some question raised as to why they were here. Well, the reason they were here is that there are a number of cities who have landlord organizations. Sworn police officers, like Representative Compton of Coon Rapids and Cowie of Bloomington, who were here, work with landlords. Community crime prevention officers work with landlords. They hold meetings. They give them neighborhood news, crime updates, education, seminars. They encourage landlords to do the right thing. They teach them crime-free multi-housing course. And first, foremost, and above all, they say screen. Their written documents say screen. They tell landlords, you gotta screen. They do everything they can to encourage landlords to screen. That's why they're not very happy with a bill that provides roadblocks to screening, that provides a disincentive to screening, that provides a reason why maybe a landlord wouldn't screen. We contacted Officer Compton in connection, I was aware of Representative Morgan's amendment a few hours ago. Thank you, I appreciate that. We contacted some of our members, some of the screening companies, and Officer Compton. We read the amendment to him. He specifically says, so that doesn't do anything. That doesn't remove the disincentive to screen. He explicitly gave us permission to use his name, saying it still is a disincentive to screen. These people work with landlords. They work with crime. They're the experts. We really ought not to ignore their advice. Finally, Madam Chair and members, this bill is very unfair to the great majority of tenants. It runs up the cost for all tenants more than is currently charged. Remember the typical situation, the average, the normal, the great majority of situations, a tenant applicant has a good record, he looks at a bunch of apartments, picks the ones he wants, applies, fills out an application, screened, approved, moves in, no problem. What we're looking at here is a situation where we are trying to penalize the great majority of good applicants to try to give some way of working with applicants who have less than stellar records. The myth is that, and we hear it all the time, never proven, never substantiated, but you hear it, is that somehow there are landlords who refuse to rent to good tenants. That somehow there are landlords who are in the business of not renting to good tenants. Well, I mean, that just simply isn't true. Landlords are looking for customers. They try to find customers. They spend tens of thousands of dollars in advertising and hiring companies to find tenants and websites and big poster ads in the paper. Someone who has a good record will have no trouble finding a place to rent. And someone with a less than good record is going to be deceived. He is going to be turned down, first of all, and that's, he gets the report by applying, getting turned down. Now he's got this piece of paper. And he is told, well, yeah, the piece of paper is expensive, but not to worry. It's widely accepted everywhere. And the fact is, it's not. I mean, if a private company were to run this deal without the blessing of law, the AG would be all over them for selling a piece of paper and telling people not to worry, you got a good piece of paper here, but it's not a good piece of paper, it's an unreliable piece of paper. It's unfair to tenants, unfair to neighborhoods, it's unfair to landlords, it is a disincentive to screening. A landlord gets one of these on his desk, one of these forms, what's he gonna do? First of all, he realizes that here's the guy in front of him who's probably been turned down already before. So, I mean, why would a tenant even use it in the first place? He'd wise up eventually, knowing that the same report that keeps getting him turned down, why would he keep giving that? You know, if you want a different result, you got to do a different thing. But even if he does try to use it, the landlord knows that he's probably got it, someone who was turned down before. So now he's got a fresh applicant in front of him, someone who can, you know, he can actually charge under the law for a screening report. And he's got this guy who he probably can't charge, or maybe he can't charge, or he's at least at the roll of the dice, whether he can charge him or not. well, who's going to take? Why is that even fair to the applicant who comes in thinking he's got a valuable piece of paper and it actually works against him? It just isn't good for anybody. A bill like this was up a number of years ago, and the Housing Finance Agency did a report. They were asked to do a report. And the fact is, in most cases, tenant screening works just fine. People apply at very few places. They get in. It's a range. Senior citizens are almost always the first time. Subsidized housing, sometimes a few more, because they've got to fit the program for one thing. And they may not have the greatest records, and there's maybe waiting lists and so on. But in virtually all cases, there's no problem. The tenant application, the screening process works just fine. So I don't know what the problem we're solving is. It clearly creates mischief, and it's something that I think we should not adopt. Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Any questions for the witness?
Representative Lane.
Is your key concern that you can't trust the report that's given to you by the renter, potential renter?
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative. That's one of the three. Unfair to tenants, can't trust the report, and opportunity for fraud and deception, which I guess is kind of part of that.
The same
point.
Thing. So unfair to tenants probably doesn't apply to your concerns, but basically whether you could trust the report. I'm wondering, just as a suggestion, could there be a screening report that is sought by, say, the initial landlord that somebody goes to, and it does not come to the renter? They basically receive a little card that says, we have your report, and you can let whoever you go to know that this is the way they can get it from, and it's good for a number of days. And then they go somewhere, and they say, well, I've already had the screening report. Here's where you can get it from. And then you can get it from there, and it's all covered in the one charge of the initial charge. And then the screening report company would know exactly who they are giving it to. No problem there that you mentioned before. You are getting it directly from them. No fraud possible. The cost, I believe you said originally, Representative, that it's a little bit above what some of them charge, so therefore the screening company is already getting a little bit more and they can afford to do this job. They don't have to do the work over again. All they got to do is pass it out. So would that take care of some of the problems?
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative. It's a great idea. In fact, seriously, and it is such a great idea that one of our companies that I testified to and spelled the story spent over $100,000 just a few years ago at the turn of the century trying to do that exact same thing. It didn't work. They had to give it up. They spent a lot of money trying to promote it, trying to sell it, trying to create. The problem is this. What you say is absolutely true, Representative Madam Chair, excuse me. It's absolutely true, the comments that you make. The problem is that for the good tenants, they don't want it, they don't need it, they don't want to pay. He was charging like 60 or 70 or 80, 75, I guess, which was actually the full cost of a kind of a multi-purpose report like this. But it worked the way that you described. A landlord would call the tenant screening company. The tenant would be given a card, and he'd present it to the next landlord. And the landlord would call the tenant screening company and say, I've got a card that entitles me to a credit report. And indeed, it would be sent off. The good tenants never used it. They couldn't attract the good, because why? Why would they pay 60, 70, 80 bucks when any other landlord would charge them 30, 35? And unfortunately, and kind of tragically, they could never get enough of the tenants with the bad records. The bad tenants would, I shouldn't say that. I don't really mean bad tenants. Tenants with difficult records, bad records. Tenants with records that make them difficult to rent to. They would go around one after another to all these landlords thinking that somehow they had bought what will eventually end up in getting an apartment. But it didn't. They had a bad record, and whether they went to one or 10 or 20 landlords, and the problem would never work, or the situation, Madam Chair, finally, would never work statewide. This was a private company that had contracts with landlords, several hundred of them. But individual contracts, as required, absolutely mandated by law, and the contracts with the credit bureau. So they had these contracts. It was their own customer list. with the landlords, and they were referring them only to their own landlords they had customers with. And that was another problem. They could never get enough landlords to sign up to create kind of a critical mass. You couldn't take these just anywhere. You could only take them to the landlords who agreed to be part of the program. It seems like it should have worked. A company spent several years and a lot of money trying to promote it, simply could not make it work for the reasons that I mentioned, Madam Chair.
Follow-up?
Oh, Representative Lane?
Under this bill, the screening companies would have a uniform screening thing that would be developed, and there would be this uniform fee. So it wouldn't be one person trying to charge a bigger fee for a better service and it didn't work. This would be one fee, one complete screening report. It would be done once. Maybe some renters, that would be it. It would just be the same as now. But others might say, well, I want to go here and go to this place now or this place, and they don't have to wait for it. They don't have to pay again. That's the purpose, my understanding, is of what the bill is for, so that somebody can go to other places and not have to have it done again. Or, as you once mentioned, Representative Blesch, coming, you know you're going to fly into Boston, well, fly into Minneapolis and look for an apartment on your weekend, and you already have it prepared ahead of time.
Madam Chair, Representative Lane, thank you.
Sure.
The problem is that under the law, you cannot do business with these multiple end users. I mean, there's over 100,000 landlords, most of them small landlords, some large companies, most of them small landlords. Many screening companies are people who could easily claim to be screening companies. Every time you see a credit report that's given to an end user, there's a contract between those two people. You can't just be distributing these credit reports willy-nilly, and we wouldn't want that to happen.
Wouldn't be willy-nilly if it was...
But I mean, the other landlords that you don't have, or any end user that you don't have a contract with.
Representative Lane? I guess that's the spot that's throwing me is if they have if it's part of the bill that any landlord then can contact that screening company and have them fax a copy within that set time frame. I don't know how the word contract applies.
Madam Chair, here's the Fair Credit Reporting Act, or FCRA is, as people call it, specifically requires, demands, I can quote the language in the section if anyone wants, says you may not, a reseller, like a screening company, may not provide credit information to anyone other than known end users who have been verified and for whom you have a contract with, that they agree not to spread the information around. Credit information is guarded very carefully, and it should be. I mean, last year this legislature spent dozens of hours in numerous committees in both bodies to try to create a anti-ID theft law that gave a little bit of additional protection and control over credit records to consumers. This would open it wide up were it not the law. The feds, our state, and consumers' interests are very strongly protective of their credit information. You cannot give it to someone who hasn't also contracted with you that he won't spread it around also.
Okay.
No, sure.
Representative Lesch is about to explode. I see that he wants to respond.
Kind of, you know,
go right ahead.
The first I heard about this crying fall of Fair Credit Reporting Act was this morning, and... but not for an email I received from one of the previous testifiers who had not even heard that they had brought this up. So I called the Attorney General's office, and I said, here's the deal. They're claiming that it's illegal under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And frankly, it's just false. As everyone up here knows, you can get a lawyer to say whatever you want. They can say underneath. Nonetheless, they said, okay, if you really scratch the Fair Credit Reporting Act, someone could attempt to make a claim on that, but that's not the point of the Fair Credit Reporting Act. You can take your credit score and you can show it to other individuals, which is the intent of this bill. As I was told by the attorney, the end user in this case is the tenant screening company that gets the credit. They're the ones that has the relationship with the
one of the three, Equifax, Experian, or whomever else, and they distribute it to the landlord. And so it's fine that way. You could probably find a lawyer who can cry foul and say no, but it's just not true. There are stories on both sides. I would also add, remember that this report is going to be developed by the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office is not going to develop a report that's illegal under federal law. They're just not going to do it. And one other thing that I would add, as long as I'm speaking, I think from what I've heard, there's additional misunderstanding, continuing misunderstanding. I didn't want to add more information because I didn't think we were going to rehash the same things that we heard last time. I wanted to save the committee that time. But in the interest of rebutting some of this, I need to say Section 2 has two subdivisions. The first one says application. The second one says form. Now, if you get a license to drive, you don't go into driver and vehicle services and get out one of those carbon forms and fill out your application for driving and tear off the form. And when you get stopped by a police officer, you pull it out of your glove box and show them that. No, that's the application. We have a uniform application. The report is something that goes through driver and vehicle services, and then you get a license, which is legitimate, which shows it's legitimate. Granted, there are cases of fraudulent driver's license, all kinds of fraudulent IDs, just like there could be cases of fraudulent reports. But this report is going to go through the ringer of a tenant screening company in the same way your driver's license goes through the ringer to make sure that all the information is correct. So such that a person ought reasonably be able to rely on the fact that it's an accurate report, not application, and similar to a driver's license. So I just wanted to raise those two points.
And Chairman, could I have one thing? Thank you. First of all, we are talking about the report. Of course, in the normal course of human activity, most reports will probably be as purported. But they don't have to be. There are some people who forge checks, some people who forge documents. Therefore, we're on the alert. We have processes. This totally circumvents all those processes that we need to protect ourselves. Secondly, Madam Chair, if I could, without reading a whole lot, I don't know how you would misinterpret anything I read to you from Section 607, Compliance Procedures, 15 U.S. Code, 1681E. Every screening company is required to follow guidelines to validate the use of the consumer reports as stated in FCRA. These procedures shall require that the respective users of the information identify themselves, certify the purpose for which the information is sought, certify the information will be used for no other purpose. Every consumer reporting agency shall make a reasonable effort to verify the identity of a new prospective user and the use certified by such user prior to furnishing such user a consumer report. It is extremely clear. I don't know, maybe it's an AG who doesn't quite familiar with FCRA, but conceivably. There is simply no question, and it should be that way. We wouldn't want someone who could just broadcast out somebody else's information. Finally, Madam Chairman, I should say in response to the excellent question of Representative Cran, I know of no landlord who right now would not tell you what his criteria are. If somebody says, you know, I got an eviction, is that going to be a problem for me? I got a misdemeanor a couple of years ago, is that going to be a problem for me? I know of no landlord who wouldn't state that. In fact, in the cities of St. Paul and Minneapolis, it's a law. You're required. The landlords have to put in writing, disclose what their criteria are. So it's not as though a tenant has to somehow undergo a lot of expense to find he's not going to be accepted. You readily can ask, but here's what happens. And we had testimony, to the FCRA stuff, too. This is not new stuff. We had testimony to all this. What happens is that residents who are trying to find a place, even knowing of a fault in the record, will insist on filling out the form and paying for it and sending it anyway, because they're hoping, of course, that it'll come back okay. And we hear this over and over again. This landlord will say, well, you know, it doesn't look like you're going to qualify. And they insist on filling it out and having it screened anyway because they're hoping that something won't be caught.
Well, I just want to say I didn't know if there were, considering that we've gone over this exhaustively in terms of the corpus of the bill, I wondered if there were If you wanted to keep it to the amendment itself, because I'd be happy.
We've already passed the amendment.
Okay.
The bill is before us. The whole bill is before us.
Okay.
Representative Moll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of things. I guess I would encourage the testifier not to imply that our newly elected attorney general can't read. You know, the second point, I'm a former coach and a physical education teacher, so I think in sports metaphors, I guess. But, you know, for a long time we always complained about the refs in football, you know, they couldn't make a good call, blah, blah, blah. And we allowed now coaches to throw in the flag. Okay, so Representative Lesh, maybe Representative Morgan's a football fan, he got this idea that, okay, the tenant or the landlord doesn't like to call the refs, you know, doesn't trust the paper, so we can throw in the coach can throw in the flag and we can review the call, and we're providing the landlord the opportunity to review the call. He's got to foot the bill, just like you lose a timeout in football if you're wrong. You know, it seems like a reasonable compromise. Applaud the author for his willingness to work with the Multi Housing Association, and I would encourage us to vote on the bill.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I just want to make a comment. I'm going to probably vote no on the bill, And I don't want to get into the legalese of it, because that's a dead-end street, and those of us who oppose it in golfing terms are dormies anyway. But I would suggest what might happen is that this piece of paper becomes a warning sign. If I'm a landlord and this paper appears at my front door, I'm going to say, uh-oh, whoever filled it out and paid the $30 in the building down the street didn't work, so now they're in my door. So that would be my concern. So I'm not sure the tenant's advantage, and then that piece of paper becomes like a bottle of red wine that has not aged for 60 days. So you don't open it. And I think you're well-intended, but I just think there's some consequences here that I, as a business person, I think it may backfire.
I think that was a statement rather than a question. That's
just a statement.
All right. Representative Eastland, Eastland, Swales, Trumper, Anderson, and Smith. We are going to vote on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question of the author of the bill. In the language, you referred to this a residential tenant report. If they require a residential tenant report to be completed, what is a residential tenant report?
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland. That's what will be developed. Well, it will be completed by a tenant screening company off of an application that's developed by the Attorney General's office in conjunction with the industry, multi-housing, and other folks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what is the normal, just the small guy that's got a few apartment buildings, you know, and
like me?
No, you're a big guy. the doesn't usually do a lot of screening or whatever, but they have an application, a fairly extensive application that they personally just use, and then they do some work. Maybe they call some of the references on there. They call the employer to verify that the employer's, you know, and they charge an application fee.
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, in that case, first of all, if they do the work themselves, no, they can't charge a fee. But in the case, like, for example, myself, off of an application, I've been in a situation where, you know, if you don't use the uniform report, you know, and you say, I just want some information, I should back up. It's kind of a regressive thing. If you're going to charge a fee, you got to use a uniform report. But if you're not going to charge a fee, you don't need to charge a fee, you can use any kind of version that you want. And, for example, in the current application that I use, I rely on all this stuff. And it says on the application, any falsification of this information is considered a material breach of your lease as well. So I'm kind of covered in that situation. But, I mean, I'm kind of a small guy, too. I've got two duplexes. I just looked at a fiveplex this afternoon to see. I don't know if it'll work out or not.
Huh?
I know, I got four-wheel drive. Yeah. But it, that's one of those things where if you want to go cheaply that way, you still can.
So, Madam Chair, that was my question. So the screening fee you're talking about here isn't necessarily the screening fee that you're paying. A screening fee would be if you're... Is it illegal to charge a fee if you're doing the work yourself now, currently?
If you want...
You don't have
to. No, if you can charge a fee to do it. If you do it yourself right now, you can still charge a fee.
So if you charge a fee, and if you call it a showing fee and a blah, blah, blah. But I mean, the point is all of those other ways of assigning or defining a fee are different. If you don't use a screening company, if you're not doing that stuff, but you're just charging a fee for having somebody in your office call a few references and do a few things to just to validate that the step that they gave you on the thing is correct, you couldn't charge a fee for that anymore under this bill. Is that what I'm hearing?
Correct. If you charge a fee under this bill, you got to use the uniform report.
Representative Eastland, I think I heard a little gap in understanding there. I think what he's saying and what the bill does is, if you do not charge a fee, this doesn't change it. If you do charge a fee, it does change it.
I'm sure, but I guess what I'm saying is, if a small guy was just charging a $25 fee to cover their own office costs, and they're not going to an outside source to do the screening, you're saying this bill would say they couldn't do that anymore.
Correct.
Okay. That's the first thing I want to clarify. Then I guess, you know, I don't see the value of the bill, quite frankly. And if I was a small guy doing that, what I would just simply do is raise my rents $5 or $10. And when there's a market, if you're in a market in a rental market, which, you know, you have rental units usually because you want to keep them rented, and if it's a rental market for the landlord's market, you can just add a little bit on to the rent, so I guess there's creative ways people are going to figure out ways to do this, so I guess I just question whether or not this is really going to accomplish what you're thinking it's going to accomplish, and I don't think it is, but I mean, and maybe in some places it will, but I don't think it will for the small guy.
Okay.
I don't think the small guy will use this.
Madam Chair, Representative Easton, first of all, absolutely. If you're a small guy, I mean, it's a legitimate way to cover your costs. Raise your rents $5, $10, whatever. For example, one thing that I typically do is, you know, if I charge an application fee and I rent to you, I take that off your first month's rent. A lot of companies do that. But, you know, you could increase your cost to cover it as well. I think that's a legitimate way to go. But I'd ask the committee to consider. I don't know if there's anyone on this committee that's ever been denied. If you've never been denied, you don't have a problem. You know, it's a non-issue. But I ask you to think about those folks who have been denied and who just want to be in a position where they don't have to go over and over to different people and take their crapshoot and gamble constantly. This is one way to do that for that individual. That's what I'm trying to accomplish here.
Okay. Next person, Representative Swell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesh, I guess for me, the sticking point with the bill when I first read it was the 60 days that this certificate would be valid for an individual. And for me, that was a problem because lives can just change within a matter of hours, and that certificate would not necessarily reflect that. When Representative Morgan and you worked through this particular amendment, I felt like that addressed for me that if the 60 days was going to remain as a part of the main part of your bill, then that seemed to address it. I would like, I mean, I feel like we have discussed this bill a lot to death. But I also know that when it did not pass before, it did not pass because of a tied vote. And I think that perhaps we should move it on to another committee for vetting, because I think we're rehashing the same issues over and over and over again, and I think perhaps... you said public safety.
Yes, public safety and civil justice.
Perhaps looking through a new set of lenses might bring some fresh discussion to this bill.
Thank you. Representative Schumper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two or three specific questions, quick questions. Representative Lesch, did you discuss the details of this report with the Attorney General? What you're expecting them to develop?
Representative Lesch.
Madam Chair, Representative Schumper, no. I haven't discussed, well, I have spoken with several attorneys in the Attorney General's office that what I anticipate would be included, but I'm not going to presume to say, and by the way, I think multi-housing is going to want this in there. I said there are going to be other parties that want their things included. And the thing is, you know, I think about multi-housing is there are going to be different landlords that are going to have very different opinions about it as well. So, you know, if they're one of the players at the table, they'll have to work through their membership and determine, okay, what do we really want in here? Similarly, other groups who are involved are going to have to work through their constituency to determine out what are the most important factors to be in. So I have stated what I think the primary factors are, and it's been stated by Mr. Horner and other people who have testified as well, and I think for the most part, they're fairly well established, the primary factors. I mean, you know, I could, like, I have on my application, you know, do you own a waterbed, right? Because I've got a duplex, waterbeds in the upstairs in my duplex. I mean, the houses are 100 years old, and boys aren't that strong. So, but, you know, I mean, that probably won't, I may or may not be in the uniform application. I don't know.
Madam Chair, second question. Do you envision other things than just a credit report in this report, in other words?
Madam Chair, Representative Schumper, yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I can just say, I've had experience. My wife and I were thinking of coming to school here a couple of years ago, and we came up here as naive country people, and we thought we could just rent an apartment. And over about 3 weekends, we applied at probably a half a dozen more or more different places, putting down a $50 deposit every time. And I suspect that happens to, you know, I think we're credit worthy. I thought we were, and we were. But, you know, it was just, that was just the situation. We had to make up, we needed housing quickly, and we made it, we had to put down multiple deposit or multiple application fees. And I assume that's what you're trying to address, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Schumper, that's exactly what I'm trying to address.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, you mentioned going to public safety. I'm also, because I sat on state government finance before, I'm thinking that because of the cost of the Attorney General having to make this form, they might want some money for that. So I know that in committee before, they've always mentioned different forms that had to have some costs involved, but that might have to go on to state government finance. This is a suggestion.
Representative Anderson, I'm going to advise the author to check with the Attorney General about whether or not they can absorb this, or they're going to have a fiscal note, and that should go with you to the next committee.
It will, and Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the fiscal note came back on this at zero.
Okay. From the Attorney General's office?
Madam
Chair, there was a fiscal note, and it did have zero agency impact.
Okay.
So I assume that means they would not.
All right, Representative Kemsch.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. I think I'm okay with the testimony tonight. I do have, you know, I do have some concerns with the 60-day limit that Representative Swales brings up, and I do like Representative Lane's idea that, I mean, I have, my biggest concern is that if we put this in the hands of the tenant themselves, that there could be some fraud. I like the idea, and I know that, Mr. Horner, you probably remember that we actually talked about some kind of a uniform system that these records would be kept and a landlord could, you know, say, I have this tenant looking, I know that they were screened at X place, can I get the report sent to me? The consumer could say, yes, I'm okay with them sending my report there. And so, I mean, I know this is going to go on another committee, which I'm also on, so I'll look forward to seeing it there. and I'm hoping in the meantime that you can, work with some of the housing folks to try to see if we can make this work for both sides. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late. I guess I'd ask Representative Lesch for a figure, since it's a week and a half, 2 weeks later, should have that figure by now. How many does this actually effect in terms of numbers that are denied claims?
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, Representative Severson, I didn't go get the numbers because the bill died.
Only mostly dead, you say, Representative Lesh.
Mostly dead.
I see, yes, okay.
So I don't have it. I'm painting the pill right now.
A little lemon in that cut, if you will. Yes.
But I could come up with it. Or not me, but someone else.
Yeah. And then, Representative Lesh, I see that Mr. Dahl's out of the room, but I guess I would ask you to consult with him. I actually know this is a very serious issue for a lot of people who are in shelter seeking housing. It's also an issue for a prospective legislator, obviously. I mean, so I think we'll have to see. Whatever kind of information you can get on that, I encourage you to do it. I have to say, this is not a brand new issue. It's one that's been before us a number of years, and I actually appreciate you bringing the bill because I think there does need to be some response to the issue that's out there, and we haven't really solved it, even though there hasn't been a response, as Mr. Horner said before. Looks like Representative McNamara has a question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was just wondering, it seems that staff, it does have a fiscal note, and I was just wondering if we'd have a chance to see that before we vote.
Absolutely, Madam Chair and Representatives. It just says zero impact for everything, but I'd be happy to have some copies made.
I just wouldn't mind if we could just take a peek, because I'm trying to realize. I know the new Attorney General is real excited about her job, and I'm impressed. I'll put my glasses on this time, but I'm impressed that she's willing to do these kind of things for nothing, because I think that'll help us as we move forward in the budgeting process to know that she has the ability. This is literally a blank fiscal note. This doesn't have anything on it at all for anybody. So I'm glad to know that both not only the state but the local will have no fiscal impact on this. Well, evidently she's going to do some things for free, so I'm encouraged by that, Madam Chair.
Okay. Members, I think we've had a very thorough discussion of this bill, and it, the motion recurs to, the Morgan motion recurs to pass this bill and we refer it to the Committee on Public Safety and Civil Justice. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
No. No.
Passed. Committee members, just to let you know, our next meeting is Tuesday. And we were going to hear from the Veterans Board, and today, as you know, is a bad day for veterans or anybody. Probably didn't come this way. A couple days ago they asked if it could be rescheduled. We are rescheduling that meeting, and they will be coming on Friday. So we have an extra meeting scheduled, a joint hearing with them and Representative Huntley's health committee. Perhaps some of you know, in the meantime, there have been some publicity on some additional problems that have occurred there. So you'll have a full chance to discuss that with them on Friday. Next Friday.
You know, Madam Chair, I just want to mention that I really appreciate you jumping on that right away, as I have one of the five veterans home in my community of Hastings. And I know my own administrator, Mr. Cox, is now taking over the job temporarily for all the homes. But I'm just troubled by the whole thing. And so thank you and Chair Huntley for scheduling that and allowing some time for some good discussion, because I hope they're coming prepared, because they should be ready for a lot of good questions to be asked.
Right, and I just want to say, if any members of the committee have witnesses that you want to have testified, please let us know. We'll make every effort to include them. Thank you, committee members. The meeting is adjourned.